From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we'll rebroadcast two of our favorite conversations later in this program. Actress Thandi Newton discusses her role in the hit HBO show Westworld, and jazz singer Norah Jones talks about her latest album, Daybreaks. But first, in this latest part of our series on higher education, we're going to take a look at blended learning, a teaching method that has received a lot of attention in education reform circles. It combines online learning with the more traditional in-classroom teaching. Proponents say it could, amongst other things, make degrees more affordable. Our guest is Dr. Thomas Cavanaugh, the Associate Vice President of Distributed Learning at the University of Central Florida. He joins us now to share his insights. Tom Cavanaugh, good to have you on this program.
Thank you for having me.
Let me jump right in. Tell me what you all are doing that everybody's paying attention to now, because you're doing it so successfully with regard to blending these online and classroom programs.
Sure. At the University of Central Florida, we're a large school. We have 64,000 students. Mm-hmm. And access is really important to us. And we really, frankly, wouldn't be that large if it wasn't for online learning, because we simply don't have the physical infrastructure mm-hmm. to support that many students. So what we offer students is a variety of modalities that they can choose from to fit their lifestyle, fit their work, their family commitments. And what we find is that close to almost 80% of our students take one or more online or blended courses throughout their academic, throughout an academic year.
Mm-hmm. Tell me how a blended program works. Like, how does one choose, or how do you know what's online, what's classroom, how do you balance the hours? I mean, how does the blended part actually work?
Sure, well, there's different levels.
Right.
So at the course level, you can blend a course where you have part of the course online, part of the course face-to-face. Mm-hmm. You kind of have the best of both worlds, the convenience of online learning and some of the social interaction piece of the face-to-face classroom. Mm-hmm. When you look at a program level, you can mix and blend a program so that you have online courses, face-to-face courses, and even blended courses. And offering a variety of options to students gives them some agency so that they can choose their own path, fit their own circumstances, whatever they might be.
Mm-hmm. I would assume then a couple things. You tell me if I'm right or wrong. I would assume that you probably have a greater diversity of students because of these options. And I would assume that the online courses are probably a little bit less expensive than what colleges charge to sit in the classroom. Am I right or wrong about either or both of those?
I think in general in online learning, your first statement is correct. But at UCF, what we find is that the diversity of the student profile is about the same mm-hmm. because online learning is so integrated into everything that we do.
Right.
At our school, what we do is that the tuition is exactly the same.
Right.
However, for certain programs, for students who are 100% online, who will never be coming to campus, we are able to reduce their out-of-pocket costs by eliminating fees that are associated with campus services that they won't be using.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be a significant, maybe a 20% discount for them.
Yep. So I'm curious as to how the success of this program is being met inside the academic community. I happen to know that that can be a very political community, the academic community.
Yeah.
How is it being received? How is it being pushed back against? How is it being talked about? And I want to come in a moment to how employers are taking this, because I remember some years ago when this online learning thing became a really big deal, there were some people sort of, how can I put this nicely, poo-pooing mm-hmm. online education, that you don't get the same kind of instruction, you don't mm-hmm. get the same kind of learning, that the online classes are not nearly as regarded as mm-hmm. in-classroom learning. So just give me some sense, first of all, of how this program is being received inside of the academic community beyond the campus of UCF.
Well, you know, the big elephant in the room is quality, right?
Yeah.
Everybody sort of brings that up.
Sure.
And I think maybe early days that was a legitimate concern, but there's been a body of research over the past 20 years that shows no significant difference between work that's done online, or at least outcomes from online and outcomes from face-to-face.
Mm-hmm.
I have a colleague at UCF who likes to say it was only since the dawn of online learning that face-to-face instruction became the gold standard mm-hmm. of quality education. And I think that there is still that element out there of people who question the validity of online learning. Mm-hmm. However, it's changing. And I think it's changing mostly from faculty who are teaching online. And they realize that they can do things online that conceivably they can't even do face-to-face, and expand the world for their students in ways that the internet provides for them.
Mm-hmm. How does the university decide then what are the criteria for whether a course can be taught online mm-hmm. versus in the classroom?
It's a dialogue with the faculty member and with the department, and ultimately it's the academic community's decision whether or not to put something online. And what I do and my department does is work with faculty to see what we can do to bring all of the resources to bear of media, of the internet, to make that a quality course. And ultimately, though, it's their decision.
Yeah. How does the university go about dealing with authenticity? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's always the question with online anything.
Sure, sure.
Is what I'm getting real? Is this really the student? Is this really the student's work that the student has turned in? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's probably the number one question that I get.
Yeah.
And there are a variety of tools and strategies that you can do, that you can employ to ensure the authenticity of a student's identity. Mm-hmm. So there's video, there is all kinds of biometrics, there are all kinds of tools that you can put in place. And we use a number of them at our school, and we're not unique. A number of schools do this. So I think you can get to a point where you have some validity that this is the student that you think it is. I would question maybe even a large lecture hall where you have a couple hundred students. Unless you're checking IDs at the door, mm-hmm. you might have a similar problem. Another question has to do with, are they cheating online? And we work really hard with our faculty to design tests that are kind of cheat-proof for mm-hmm. online, so you're not just testing cognitive
recall. Is there such a thing?
Well, no, actually.
Not when I was in school. I'm not speaking for myself. I'm just my friends.
I have a friend.
Yeah, I have a friend. Yeah.
No, there's no cheat-proof anything, face-to-face or online.
Right.
However, I think there are some tools in the online world that aren't available in the face-to-face world. You can randomize questions, you can time exams, you can use pools of questions, you can check IP addresses to make sure students aren't colluding together. There's all mm-hmm. kinds of tools that you can use that I think help to mitigate that issue.
It seems to me, though, that while you can do that, that puts an additional burden on the faculty member to have to go through all those checks and balances, so to speak, and how do they respond to being asked to do that additional legwork?
Some of it, I would say, falls on folks like myself,
right.
the more technical solutions. But in the course and assessment design, I think that if a faculty member builds that in up front, it's not really a whole lot more work if they've got resources like ours to help them.
Mm-hmm. So the other question I want to get to here is, beyond how it's received in the academic community or not received by some institutions, mm-hmm. how's it being regarded in the world of employment? So when one gets these degrees, what do you know, is it too soon to tell, you tell me, about whether or not these online degrees lead to jobs?
I think it depends on the credibility of the institution.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a degree from a respected, accredited institution, regardless of the modality that it's delivered in, then I think it's the reputation of that institution that speaks to how valid that degree is.
Mm-hmm.
If it's some sort of an institution that's not accredited or that's had problems with some scandals or something like that, then I would question that. I would question that whether it's face-to-face or online.
Yeah.
In some cases, many of those kinds of schools happen to offer a large number of online programs.
Yeah.
And I think in some cases, online learning has been painted with a broad brush, driven by some of the bad actors in the space.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, most public institutions like mine, a lot of private institutions, offer online learning, and I would put the quality of it up there with anything face-to-face.
And I would assume then that there's no difference in the degree. There's nothing on the degree that says that this student received this degree for taking, there's no.
No,
yeah.
There's not. It's the same faculty,
it's
the same curriculum, same outcome, same requirements. And in some cases, like I said, 80% of our students will take a mixture of modalities.
Right.
They might take most face-to-face and a few online, or most online and some face-to-face, or all online. It's really kind of up to the student.
Yeah. So tell me what you think the future holds, because I can see this working a couple different ways. I can make the argument that it's a good thing and it's a bad thing. From the standpoint of the institution, as long as you got enough people signing up for this and there's money being made, not that I want to reduce education to money, but institutions have to survive. If you're giving discounts to these online students, that's less money ultimately coming into the institution if over the long run you see more kids signing up for online courses than for classroom courses. Mm-hmm. That could be a challenge for the institution. On the other hand, there are these questions that of course remain about, and you addressed some of them now, about the validity of this online learning. So I'm just trying to get a sense of where you think the future is going to take us with regard to how we do these blended courses.
I think by and large, we're turning the corner on those questions of is this quality. I think we've got enough literature, enough research, enough just anecdotal evidence of people we know who've gone through programs like this to say that, okay, this can be a quality experience. you know, to your first point about the finances, mm-hmm. We like to think that making money is sort of the worst reason to get into this. Mm-hmm. It should be for other reasons, to support institutional mission, access, you know, success, helping students to make their way through a degree program. And then if you do all those things right, the money sort of takes care of itself. Mm-hmm. And in our case, the discount that we've applied to our fully online programs is only in fees. So it's for services the students aren't accessing anyway. Right. So the tuition revenue, if you will, remains the same.
Yeah. You think by and large, this is a good turn for academia in America?
I think it is, in the sense that there are some students, there's a whole population of students, particularly mm-hmm. underserved students, underrepresented students, who must work, who have family commitments, and want to get an education. And they can't quit their job and go Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 10 o'clock in the morning to a class. Online learning offers them a path that wasn't there before. And I think that we can make that available to students to help them improve their situations, to get the education that they want. Mm-hmm. I also think that there are technologies that are being experimented in through online learning, like adaptive learning and personalized learning, that potentially could have an impact in the future if they prove to be successful.
Tom Cavanaugh from UCF. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good to have you on. Thanks for your insights. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Tandy Newton's work in film and TV includes the critically acclaimed hit Crash, W by Oliver Stone, The Pursuit of Happiness, which also starred Will Smith. Her latest role is in the HBO drama Westworld, based on the 1973 movie of the same name. It's a series about the dawn of artificial consciousness and the evolution of sin. She's here now to tell us more about the project, but first, here's a clip from Westworld.
You're new. Not much of a brand, are you? I'll give you a discount.
I have no offense, but I'd rather earn a woman's affection than pay for it.
Well, you're always paying for it, darling. And the difference is our costs are fixed and posted right there on the door.
No truer words have ever been uttered.
You're paying for it one way or the other, I suspect. Your prices are just posted.
When I saw that you were playing a madam, I've always known you to play these really tough, gritty sort of characters. And how does this fit into your body of work?
The lexicon.
Yeah.
Oh, in the best way.
Yeah.
I feel like I've been acting now for 25 years.
Can't believe it.
And
started when you were two.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this feels like the magnum opus. This is like, I would actually feel when I was on set that I didn't have to take off my women's rights hat. I wouldn't have to take off my human rights activist mm-hmm. hat. I didn't have to take off my, you know, rights for minors, young people mm-hmm. hat. And this is the stuff that matters more to me than anything.
Yeah.
And work. I'm not being cynical, but I have to find work that is allowing me to pay bills mm-hmm. and keep our, you know, lives going in a way that we're used to, and trying not to betray my political beliefs while I'm doing it. And listen, it's a tough thing to do as an actor. You only have a degree of control, but with Westworld, I was absolutely blown away when I first talked to Lisa Joy and Jonah Nolan at how ambitious they wanted Westworld to be in looking at the drives that are leading human beings over the cliff mm-hmm. of existence. You know, it's, for me, I feel like it's this kind of drive towards mass suicide, because so many of the problems that we're facing are interconnected, right. Whether it's rape of women, rape of the environment, all of these factors suppressing life, suppressing joy, suppressing love are the things that will lead to our extinction.
Yeah. Back up and unpack for me how it is that you, through this character, don't have to
leave my
activist hat.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, yeah. Well, because, and it was interesting for me on a personal level as well as a professional, but let me talk about the professional first.
Sure.
That by playing a woman who is actually the instigator of sexual violence against women, because whatever happens in Westworld stays in Westworld. So these prostitutes that are there for your benefit, mm-hmm. potentially, you can do whatever you want to them. If your appetite, you know, tips over into violence, murder even, no one's going to get to know about it. So in Westworld, you can do whatever you want. Let's not sit here, you and I, Tavis, now, and pretend that this does not happen in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Every, you know, look at the deep net, the dark net, or however you want to describe mm-hmm. it, the, you know, sex trafficking, pornography, terrible crimes committed by pederasts. This stuff is systemic. It's mm-hmm. it's actually, you know, it's just as much a part of our global economy as the transparent global economy, or so we think,
yeah.
you know, that's there. We have to start coming clean with ourselves. We have to start recognizing that every single one of us has the potential to be violent, has the potential to be cruel, has the potential to be destructive. It's about how we're brought up. It's about our education. It's about what abuse we've suffered. If we don't start getting wise to these things, we are going to end up pushing ourselves and everyone around us over the cliff edge.
And yet, how many times have you heard people say, I could never do that?
If you say
I
that,
never do
is
that.
A very strong chance that you could. And
yeah.
this is here's the thing.
Yeah.
If you respond to something with horror, I could never do that, what you're actually feeling is terrible fear that you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to allow our curiosity to lead to empathy. But we see we're all the construct, what we've created, the infrastructure that deals with crime, deals with sin,
mm-hmm.
is locked into, you know, hundreds, maybe even thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
And sin is the flip side to goodness, kindness. You know, it's the yin to the yang. We have to understand sin. Anthony Hopkins has a great line in the show, which is, in order to understand God, you have to be acquainted with the devil.
Mm-hmm.
We have to know these things, but there's a great deal of fear around wrongdoing because people die,
yeah.
people are horribly hurt, and it's a lot to be afraid of. So we tend not to want to look at the dark side.
Yeah.
But then if you don't look at the dark side, you find yourself suddenly in the dark side.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because look, mm-hmm. no matter how we try and protect ourselves from this and that, isn't it like life that stuff happens? You're like, mm-hmm. what was the whole point? How many people in America paid their payments, you know, month after month, and then there was the crisis with the banks and they've got no homes?
Mm-hmm.
How many people have been paying their insurance year after year and suddenly, you know, Obama brings in Obamacare? It's like, but I've been sacrificing all these years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a degree of sacrifice. There is a degree of pain in understanding, you know, we can't control everything. And so we have to look at having greater awareness about who we are as a humanity and what we can do to prevent the things that motivate us to hurt each
yeah.
other, to lie to each other, to use each other, to get rich and obese on wealth that is of no service to
yeah.
humanity. You know, we're all locked into these things. We're ashamed of them. We hide them. There's corruption. You know, we're in a golden age, a platinum age. Let's go
yeah.
greater than gold.
Yeah, yeah.
Where there is more transparency than ever before. You know, yes, we're WikiLeaks and you know, suppression of information
mm-hmm.
it's over
yeah.
to a degree, you know. So what do we do with that? And that's what Westworld is really reflecting, is that we are in this time where people do whatever they want and then they get found out.
Yeah.
So now that we know these things, now that we know we have this propensity for violence, for abuse, for destroying innocence, for destroying women, which is basically all leading to suicide,
sure, sure.
you know, destroying the environment, destroying the oceans, the fish, you know. Now that we know these things, we're so smart. We're as smart as the robots in Westworld because we program the robots.
Yeah.
And what we see with Westworld, which is so incredible, is that when the robots get a sense of who they are, and they've been actually programmed to be abused. My character is programmed to just use my girls like a factory farm of sex.
Yeah.
Once my character realizes that I've been programmed to do it, not only do I realize it's just about the most ignorant, pathetic thing to do because it's going to end up with suicide of the population, and okay, I need to teach these humans to program themselves and artificial intelligence a bit better.
Yeah.
That's the premise.
Yeah.
So I play a madam in order to then look at what that means.
Right.
And that is the premise of Westworld. We have to show it so that we can then speak about it, be honest about it, see the consequences, the ramifications, because that's key, isn't it?
Yeah.
If we look at the dark side, if we just hold hands and peer in and help each other not to be afraid of what we're seeing in ourselves, maybe we can do something about it. It's never gonna be perfect, whatever that means, you know? And I just feel like there's so much hanging over from the past, whether it's literature, whether it's policies, whether it's great men and women from the past that have said certain things. If we don't update, if we don't update our information, we're not living in the current real world. We have to update information.
So I'm tickled on the inside because you explained this so brilliantly and so beautifully. And only in Hollywood could you take all that and find some entertainment value in it.
Well, otherwise no one's going to watch, babe.
That's my point. That's
no one's going to watch.
That's what cracks me up. I mean, I love watching stuff that both empowers me and entertains me.
Oh, yes.
Entertains me.
Yes.
I love watching stuff that challenges me to re-examine my assumptions, to expand my inventory of ideas, and yet entertain me at the same time. That's not always easy to do in this business, though.
Well, it's like food,
you
know? Yes, we can just eat food in order to nourish our bodies, but if we put a little spice in there, if we put a little love in there, it's gonna taste better and still nourish us.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Yeah. It'll be more memorable if we do it like that. Maybe your kids will want to come home to have that delicious food if we spice it right. That's my, I guess, my analogy for entertainment. You know, but we mustn't allow entertainment. I mean, I say we mustn't, but you know, it's gonna happen. And it is already happening. Entertainment is also mass production in the same way. I'm talking about food. Mm-hmm. That spice, Tavis. Yeah. Those beautiful dishes that you remember your mother making, your father making, your aunt, whatever. Or is it mass-produced food that you don't know where it's from? Da, da, da.
Yeah.
This is what I mean about the intersectionality of everything, the interconnectedness. We're forgetting that a meal can change everything, the smells. It can evoke something from the past that matters to you, that you love. And that's what marketing's all about, is making you feel like that fast food is giving you what mama made you and all this nonsense, when actually we're just being lied to so that we can just reach into our pockets and pay the money. We have all the power.
Yeah.
Us consumers have all the power. And if we can show that, hey, I want transparency. Hey, I want something that's going to be nutritious and great. Then suddenly kale will be all over the marketplace and turmeric will be everywhere.
God help me if kale's everywhere.
Let's just talk about kale for a second, all right? Yes, it's good for you. Yes, it's got nutritional value and so on. But this is just what I mean about intersectionality and about us waking up and please, please, we deserve answers that are honest and real. I was on set last year and I was talking to some guys in the crew about what they did for the weekend, and this guy was saying, oh, I did a bit of gardening on the weekend, and oh, that kale, you can't get rid of it. It's just once it's in the ground, it doesn't want to go. I said, seriously?
Yeah.
He said, yes, just like a weed, you just can't get rid of it. I said, well, that's why we've been told that kale's the best thing to eat, because it's easy to grow, you cannot get rid of it, it's hardy in difficult environments, and you can sell it for a hell of a lot more money than it costs to produce. Now, what I'm not saying that kale's bad. Look, kale's great.
Yeah.
But we are sold ideas that we think we invented, but we're being programmed. Everything we see, every marketing, and it's clever, and we are brilliant. People are so, so clever. But it's about using that clever to promote love, to promote community, to promote protection of the young, to promote protection of women, because they are literally the future of humanity. Look, maybe a lot of human beings don't want to live, so let's just forget about protecting women and children. Let's just forget about it. Doesn't matter, you know? But that says something too. That says something too. How bankrupt are we? If our souls are bankrupt that we don't want to ensure the world for the next seven generations. That's so sad.
How are we being fellow citizens, being programmed in this election season to the extent that you think we are being programmed?
Well, this is the interesting thing. This is looking underneath the programming, isn't it? I was watching the debate too. It's all there for us to see. You know, that's as honest as that's gonna get. You know, and there are a lot of lies being told, and not just lies, I wrote that in a tweet. Now I don't write that, you know, I don't think that anymore. So it's not like things are necessarily hidden. So it's about the choices we make, you know. So in that, as an example that you were saying, you know, about the election process, and let's talk about the debate. How does that work as a program? Okay, so there is literally a program. There we see it. We take that programming and we add it to our program. If we are people who are frustrated and we have, if the rhetoric that we hear corresponds with our fear, our sadness, our, you know, it's great marketing. We're going to say, yes, you. If your history, Hillary Clinton, corresponds with my education meant everything to me, my children, you know, supporting my husband, then are we going to vote for Hillary? It's about tapping into whatever programming is already in you. Okay, so it's, what I'm saying is, we're not all robots, of course we're not, but if we're aware that we are being influenced every day, let's be really clear that that's happening, and let's make some choices based on what we think. And look, a lot of us are making choices, but we're not being heard. You know, I remember marching because I didn't want, you know, Britain to go to Iraq, and I was in a march with my little girl on my shoulders, my husband. There were a million of us walking through London. I was thinking, this is going to do something. This is a peaceful demonstration. It did nothing. Yeah. What that does to the psychology of an entire country, of the world, that you're not heard, and the suspicion that I vote in this way and nothing's happening. That suspicion leads to mass fear, suspicion. And, you know, there's a lot to prove that suspicion and fear is actually makes a group of people easier to control.
Sure.
So let's not try and correct that fear and suspicion, because, you know, they're easy targets when they're afraid. So let's all, how can we not be afraid? By getting to know each other. Because you're afraid of what you don't know. That's what you're afraid of. You can just sense something's not right, because we're really clever and we're really intuitive human beings. So we can sense there's something wrong. If we're given programming that says, it's the people next door who don't look like you, they're responsible for everything that's wrong, then we're going to believe it. And we're going to attack those people. And we're going to be busy doing that while they're off out trading in arms and money and grossness that we then have to, sorry, it makes me so cross, that we then have to admit, well, that's my country doing that. We're all the same, and we all want the same thing. We all want to be secure. We all want food on the table. We want to know that our kids aren't going to be destroyed when they're not with us. We all want the same things. And if we've been hurt in our childhoods, we try and recreate the same hurt. We try and recreate the same hell, because that's the only thing that we believe is true.
I'm listening to you as I always do, and every time you come on, I'm always so empowered and enlightened.
That's very flattering because you do the same for so many people.
I'm not being, I appreciate that, but I mean, I always learn from you. I learn from you all the time, and I'm challenged by you. So I'm trying to process how you process this as an artist, so that your role, your calling, your vocation,
your
avocation in the world is to express this through your art.
Yes.
How do you, like, put that together for me?
Well,
it must be tough for you to choose roles when you're this enlightened about the world and the way you see the world.
Well, I just think I've been in a very lucky situation, and a lot of what I've come to understand has been through the harsh knocks that my business has given me. I call it my business, okay? And also, life, the harsh knocks of life. And also, I haven't felt that I've been able to learn through my work. It's not strictly through the work, through the script and so on. It's been more about the people I've met and the environments and that creativity, which tends to do away with, a creative environment tends to do away with any kind of prejudice of the people involved, because difference is actually recognized as a good thing. Makes you stand out. It means you have value in the group. It's a more dynamic group if you've got difference in there, which is true for life, right? But with Westworld, it was the distillation of so many of the things that I've come to value, which is the search for the truth. The search for the truth. It's been incredibly important in my life personally, incredibly important. Once I understood that X, Y, and Z led to this unhappiness here and my feelings of deep insecurity and shame and so on, as I unpicked it and just saw the reality that everyone's doing their best, no one's to blame, I'm free. I'm free from that programming that I didn't have any influence over, right? I'm not angry. I'm a bit angry about some things. Mm. But I try and change that anger to energy, to just keep pushing forward, to encourage people to not to be afraid of the truth and to recognize that they're not alone. And that is what I can do with my work, without a doubt. Getting into the homes of people. But then I have found, oftentimes, I've been involved in projects that I think have actually betrayed those mm-hmm. important things. And what I do then is I just remove myself if I can. Mm-hmm. Because I have the benefit that, you know, I won't get sacked on the spot because mm-hmm. I'm in the movie or the mm-hmm. show or whatever. So I can, you know, I have more authority to be able to make certain changes. Mm-hmm. And if I can't do that just because it's betraying my politics, you know, my belief, then I'll try and remove myself. But it's tough. And more I've been moving to writing. I've written, you know, a project that I want to direct. And I thought that was my future, was writing and talking, speaking, directing. Yeah. But with Westworld, it's been really shocking to me that it's been a place where I feel, basically Lisa Joy and Jonah Nolan, we have the same, it feels like we have the same desire to look into the mirror.
Yeah, I hear that and I feel that, and one can see that when they see the series on HBO, Westworld. You mentioned the word truth two or three times. What I have been struggling with so much of late is what happens when you inhabit a world where there is less and less value placed on truth.
Yes.
And that's the part that's getting scary for me.
Oh, my goodness.
We see it playing out in so many different ways where there's just less value placed on truth.
Well, because here's the thing.
Yeah.
The truth, there's versions of it.
Of course.
You look at any kind of criminal case, you know, your truth is going to be different to my truth. But we're talking about truths about things happening. When I talk about truth, I'm talking about the bigger truth, which is how, you know, it is our fear of the unknown, our fear of the great unknown, which is obviously death, and how that motivates us in everything we do. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm talking about. And there are different versions for people, you know, whether it's, you know, different religions, philosophies, and so on. And then we get so addicted to that that then we start fighting with each other when we're all just trying to do the same thing, which is to find a way to calm our nerves about the undisputed, you know, end to our lives.
Yeah, I would just get...
And that's what it's all about, you know? Yeah. And I don't think anybody would argue with that.
Yeah, I don't think so. I was just giving a talk about this notion of truth, and as I was saying earlier...
It's the great truth. Yeah, and here's the thing about truth, Tavis. Yeah. I read this recently, and it just blew my mind. You don't have to believe in the truth, because it's the truth.
Yeah, yeah. My mother says that all the time.
You don't need belief. As soon as you say, I believe, as soon as someone's saying, I believe... Be wary, because you don't have to bang someone over the head with your beliefs, because the truth, the real truth, the fundamental truth doesn't have to be believed, because it's the truth.
My mother says this all the time. She's been telling me since I was a kid, and I've come to believe this since I was literally 5 or 6, that the truth, this is George Smiley's original, that the truth needs no defense.
It doesn't need any defense.
The
what a beautiful thing.
The truth never, ever needs
a
defense.
Oh, your mum is awesome.
Says it all the time.
She's amazing, babe.
Yeah. Well,
that's your mama.
So are you.
That's your mother.
You're pretty amazing.
What an amazing woman. I love her dearly.
And your children are blessed, all three of them, to have you as their mother. So.
Oh, I love my babies.
Yeah, I know
you
do.
We all love our babies.
And we love Tandy. The new show is called Westworld. It's on HBO. And as I said earlier in this conversation, I am always enlightened, empowered, inspired when she shows up on this program. So much insight.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Nora Jones is a 9-time Grammy winner. Her latest CD, called Daybreaks, was released in October. Before our conversation begins, though, hear now an excerpt of the first single from her album. It's called Carry On.
And after all's been said and done, who said it best? Were you the one? Let's just forget, leave it behind, and carry on. If you should find the time to speak, then speak to me. I'd never keep you from your final destiny. So carry on.
It sounds and feels like a kindred spirit to come away with me to that that first big project. Did you want me to feel that way when I heard it?
I mean, that wasn't my intention, but yeah. I think when I recorded it and was writing the songs, it was a lot of piano going on, and I definitely, you know, wanted it to sound a little more stripped down than my last record, because that was with Danger Mouse,
sure,
so it was totally different sonically.
Are you? This is 6 projects in for you now. Are you finding with each project that it gets more difficult or easier to come up with a new treatment?
To not, like, repeat myself?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think for me, I don't really go into the studio until I'm excited by something. And so I sort of let that lead whatever direction the project is taking. So I don't find it difficult. I mean, there's so much out there to be done, you know, musically.
To your point, there's a lot of piano on here, and I love it because you're so great on piano.
Thanks.
What did you have in mind when you, to your point, felt ready to go back into the studio for this project?
Well, it started out with the show I did at the Kennedy Center for the Blue Note Records 75th anniversary, and I got to play with Wayne Shorter, which was amazing, and Brian Blade, and John Patitucci, and I just kind of thought, oh, this was fun. I kind of want to play with them again. I wonder how I can make that happen, you know? And then I started thinking about recording, and then I started writing songs, which took me in a little bit of a different direction than what I had originally thought. And then it just, it's just kind of about all the songs are done and seeing how they want to be played, you know?
Yeah. What's everybody's process is different, but what's your artistic process for deciding when specifically you're going in? I hear your point earlier that you don't go in until you feel like you're ready to go in, but in terms of the songs, I mean, do you have to, I mean, are you writing 25 songs and you say, I'm ready to go in? Are you writing, what, like, what's your process? Because there are 12 songs on this.
There were no extra songs, I will say that.
That's my next question. You remind me. Okay.
There usually are a few, you know, but this time there were no extras, and we had to find some covers to put in. But I don't know. I think for me, it's just about feeling like, oh, I want to try this. And it doesn't have to feel like I'm making a record. For me, every time I go in the studio, it's like, oh, let's see what this sounds like. And if it turns into something, great. And if it doesn't, fine.
Yeah.
You know?
When you said, find some covers. I love asking this question of artists who do covers periodically. What is it that Nora Jones specifically is listening for? What is it that you need to hear on a particular track to know that you can give it the Nora Jones treatment?
Well, I guess it just depends on what you're looking for. Yeah. You know, in this case, I was looking for a few songs to round out the record. And you really just have to feel like you can own the song and deliver it like you wrote it. That's really all it you need, which is kind of a big thing, but it also is a very simple thing.
Pick a track in one of the covers and tell me why you chose it.
Well, I chose Fleurette Africaine, the Duke Ellington song, because I was listening to it a lot before Wayne Shorter came in to record. Because I wanted to write a song that had that thing that song has, and I ended up not. And so I did that song instead. And it's an incredible song, but it doesn't have lyrics, so I just kind of hummed the melody.
Yeah. I said to you when you sat down that sometimes you get a project, or I get a project, and I'll put it in, and I'll listen to it, and I'll get to one track like, you got 12 tracks here. So in this case, you get to track three. Mm-hmm. And the song is so powerful that, for me at least, you sort of get stuck there. And it takes me a couple of weeks to hear the whole thing.
That's great.
Because I keep playing that same track over and over. Tell me about this third track, Flipside.
Flipside, yeah. That was a really fun one to play. When it came to the lyrics, you know, it came in a lot of different segments. You know, sometimes you don't finish a song all in one go, sometimes you do. And I think that one, I was listening a lot to Compared to What, that old Les McCann, Eddie Harris version. And it's still topical today. And it's also, it makes you want to dance, kind of. And I don't know, I was just kind of really inspired by that song. And also just watching it a lot of news and, you know, being depressed over it. But
yeah. I hear you and I feel you. So what's happening in the world around you gets in your head, but you're also a mother now.
Yeah.
You have two babies now. Mm-hmm. How is that, to the extent it has, impacted you artistically?
I mean, I think just personally it impacts you, and that however that seeps into what you're doing, is it's hard to really specify.
Yeah.
It does change the way I hear love songs, which is something kind of interesting. Well, there's different kinds of love now. Yeah. Once you have kids, you kind of realize that. And, you know, a song like the song God Only Knows by by Brian Wilson, the Beach Boys song. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've always loved that song, and I've always thought of it in terms of just regular love between two people. But when I had my son, I definitely started singing it to him and thinking about, oh, my God, this is totally about a kid. But I don't know what it's about. That's just my own manifestation.
Yeah. Back to this point again, that there's a lot of piano on this, which is, again, I love it. I don't know that I can answer this question, but I'm sure that Norah Jones can, which is whether or not six projects in, do you hear yourself, do you feel yourself getting better?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I mean, not overnight, of course, but I think, you know, I was really playing a lot of piano on this record, and it was so fun. And I think I'm playing piano in a much different way. I'm digging in a little more, and I think part of the reason I didn't write a lot of songs on piano early on. I kind of switched to the guitar is because I felt like anything I tried to write on piano sounded too piano-y.
Yeah.
And now I don't feel that way. And I think it's just because I'm playing it differently. You know, I'm like banging a little harder. I don't know. It's just kind of it always evolves. And it's just, you know, it's been a while. So.
So I was thinking the other day, when you started, you know, it's now 15 years ago when we first, when the nation got to know of you 15 years ago, when you were signed, you really were, and I say this as a compliment, you were...
Oh, good. No. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay, let me try that again. 15 years ago, when you were signed, you really were like an outlier. And you've gone from being an outlier to like the ultimate insider. And I was thinking about that and wondering, what have you learned on this journey from, again, being signed as an outlier? Your style was different. Mm-hmm. Your sound was different. Your approach was different. So you were an outlier. Now you're like the ultimate insider. Everybody loves Norah Jones. What have you learned on that sort of, that's a big question. What have you learned on that sort of 15-year journey?
Oh, gosh. Well, that's a good question. Yeah. I guess I've learned that... you just gotta do what you love.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what kind of music you play, and that'll come through in the music, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of other weird stuff.
Yeah. What have you learned about the business of making
the business music? has changed a lot since I had my first record.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think it's a lot harder for young artists now to make money doing it, but it's a lot easier to get their name out there, but only if they're really good at self-promotion. You know, it's all really kind of a mixed bag, and I try to just focus on the music and, you know, surround myself with good managers. I have a great record label, you know. I'm lucky in that way.
Yeah.
But I don't know, it's changed a lot.
Yeah. How cool was it this summer playing both of those Newport gigs?
That was really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was fun, and I treated them very differently. Mm-hmm. I had two different bands, both great bands, but, you know, the Jazz Fest band was definitely guys who play a lot of jazz, and Folk Fest band, you know, they're amazing country rock musicians. So it was really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Six projects in, clearly you're still making music. You're still enjoying the process of doing it live?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I try to treat music as my hobby still, and I only try to do it when I'm excited to do it. I try not to pack too much into a tour to where we all get too tired. I mean, we got to work, but
I'm lucky because I don't have to hit it too hard. You know, I can take a lot of breaks.
Yeah. When you say treatment's like a hobby, I think I get that, but just so I'm clear, what do you mean by that?
I mean, I don't go in every day like a job and play the piano. Yeah, I mean, I don't, like, when I'm writing or when I'm recording, I'm not thinking about what the label will think or record sales. I try to just keep it fun and you know, the part of the job that is a job, you know, I keep that. I have a good business mind, surprisingly, for an artist.
I'm
a little type A, but but creatively, I'm kind of, you know, I like to keep it loose and fun and not think of it like a business, musically, you know?
Yeah. When you said that you don't go into the studio, I hear you and I respect you for not going in thinking that you have to do something that's commercially viable.
Yeah.
But it must feel good, though, that to go in to do what you feel like doing, and when you come out, it is commercially viable.
I mean, who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
We don't know yet. You know, I make
a bold prediction.
I don't know.
Or not so bold prediction.
Or not. I mean, who can predict? I mean, most people don't buy CDs anymore, so I don't know what that means anymore.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, does it mean how many streams you have? Does it mean, I don't know. That's why I try to focus on the music part and kind of, you know.
I think what it means is that when Norah Jones puts out a new project, we're going to get it and we're going to listen to it and we're going to love it. The new project from Norah Jones is called Day Breaks. A lot of good stuff on here that I know you will enjoy. Available everywhere. You can get it. Norah, good to have you back. It's been too long, but come see us again.
Thank you.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.